This is James Coover with K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District with your Extension Crop Report. It's a fire sale here, and everything is being baled. Corn stalks and failed soybeans have already been hayed, but there is one more possibility to go: double crop soybeans and wheat stubble. Normally, we would never bale straw and soybean residue, and for good reason. It's not great forage. Soybean residue is only 35% digestible with 4% protein. Straw is not much better at 40% digestible and 4% protein. This is where the possibility of ammonination comes in. Ammonination is the process of gassing low-quality forage with anhydrous ammonia. The ammonia combines with water in the bale to form ammonia hydroxide. This powerful alkaline compound breaks down cellulose and lignin in the bale. This improves protein, digestibility, and palatability of low-quality forages. Crude protein is generally improved by 6%, but only half of that is digestible. Total digestibility is improved by 10% on average. Bales need to have at least 10% moisture, but can be high as 30%. This can only be done with low-quality forages with little carbohydrate content, such as corn and milo stalks, poor quality native hay, straw, and soybean stubble. Generally, forages with less than 5% crude protein and 45% total digestible nutrients are safe for ammonization. High carb content forage like corn and soybean silage, alfalfa, or any other high quality hay will create toxic compounds when ammoniated. The most common method of ammoniation is stacking bales in a big pyramid on top of a perforated pipe. The pyramid is covered in a sheet of plastic with edges covered in gravel or dirt to create a sealed chamber. Anhydrous ammonia is gassed into the perforated pipe and into the covered bales. Once sealed, the conversion process takes between 2 weeks to 2 months, depending on the temperature. The bales also need some time to air out after uncovering. Bales are ammoniated from a 1.5 to 3% on a dry matter basis. At 3%, that's 60 pounds of ammonia per dry matter ton. It's important to remember to be careful with anhydrous gas, as it is dangerous to work with. Wear protective equipment and follow safety guidelines. The cost of ammonination will be around $33 to $54 per dry matter ton, or around $17 to $26 per bale. This depends on how much ammonia is used and other material costs in the process. After the cost of baling and for the fertilizer cost in the bales, the ammoniated wheat soybean stubble will cost around $50 to $60 per bale, before considerations like labor and transport. It is a little pricey and labor-intensive process, but it does take low-quality field storage that we wouldn't normally even consider baling and turn it into something close to an average prairie hay equivalent, something to consider in a drought year like this one. If you have any questions over ammoniation forages, please give me a call at 620-724-8233. This has been James Coover with your Extension Crop Report.
Next up, we'll have Wendy Powell, Livestock Production Agent for the Wildcat District.
Hi, this is Wendy Powell, your Livestock Production Agent with the Wildcat Extension District.
Winter supplementation often focuses heavily on meeting protein and energy requirements and tends to leave mineral nutrition as an afterthought. Missing the mark in any nutrient category, including vitamins or minerals, can have negative effects. All nutrients interact, so deficiencies in one element can create inadequacies of other nutrients, even if those nutrients are supplied in the correct amount. During winter months, locally grown forages are typically the basis of cattle diets. The mineral content in the forage is based on the mineral content of the soils they're grown on, which can be highly variable because of the soil formation process from one region to another. Mineral composition can even change from one pasture to the next. To complicate the matter further, the mineral content and availability are not the same thing. The digestibility of the forage impacts the availability of the mineral. High-quality grasses that have high digestibility will have, not surprisingly, greater mineral availability. Due to the annual change in weather conditions, mineral supplement strategy should be reviewed annually. Evaluate the mineral availability in forage, protein supplements, and water. Compare this amount to the requirement of your livestock to formulate an effective plan. The plan should fill any gaps of deficiencies to make sure all interactions can happen as needed. Interactions among minerals can be antagonistic, binding with each other and reducing animal availability. Sometimes an excess of one element has to be fed to overcome this binding. Secondly, excess minerals can cause toxicity. It's critical that needless supplementation is avoided to keep down costs and toxicity concerns. Feed and water testing are needed to fine-tune a formulation. While this involves upfront effort and expense to sample and measure mineral content, it has the potential advantages of improved animal performance, reduced costs by overfeeding a mineral, prevention of unfavorable interactions, and prevention of toxicity. Referring to forage mineral content, typically calcium levels are adequate and phosphorus levels tend to be deficient, especially in mature forages. So, phosphorus supplementation is usually necessary. Some basic guidelines for winter mineral supplementation programs are: always provide trace mineralized salt at a minimum. Supplement phosphorus when forage is dormant unless distiller's grain is being used as a protein source. Supplement copper if symptoms are present, but be sure to monitor copper status to ensure deficiency is solved without reaching toxic levels. Because commercial mineral and salt products are formulated to meet generalized conditions, it's helpful to create a custom blended formula to meet local deficiencies or toxicities of a specific ranch. For more information, give me a call at the Labette County Extension Office, 620-784-5337.
Thanks, Wendy. And now, here's Davin Skrantz, Natural Resource and Diversified Ag Agent, with her report.
This is Davin Skrantz, one of the Agriculture and Natural Resource Agents from the K-State Research and Extension Wildcat District of Crawford, Labette, Montgomery, and Wilson Counties with your K-State Research and Extension report. Coyotes are the number one predator of livestock in Kansas and in most of the western United States. In general, individual coyotes will range over areas of about 10 to 25 square miles, and those ranges usually overlap to varying degrees. Kansas coyotes are accustomed to human odor. They are active primarily at night, but may venture close to houses even in broad daylight if terrain or cover are adequate for concealment. In Kansas, coyotes normally go under or through fences whenever possible. However, they are capable of jumping or climbing over fences and will do so under some circumstances. Not all coyotes kill livestock. Those coyotes which are killing livestock are usually referred to as offending animals. It is desirable when using lethal control methods to direct those methods at offending animals. Of course, there's no way to look at any individual coyote through a rifle scope or in a trap and be able to tell whether or not it is an offending animal. However, in a damaged situation, control methods can be concentrated in and around the damaged area and along coyote travel routes to and from the area. When this is done, there's reasonable assurance that the offending coyote will be among the first few coyotes captured. Predation on livestock appears to bear some relationship to coyotes' seasonal energy needs. Coyotes breed in February and have one litter of 5 to 7 pups in late April or May. During and immediately following this spring whelping season, coyote energy demands increase rapidly as the parents provide food for the young. At this time, some coyotes turn to livestock as a readily available source of food. In late summer and early fall, another increase in coyote predation is usually noted. At this time of year, the food demands of the large and fast-growing pups may tend to be more than the ability of the adults to provide them with natural foods. Again, domestic livestock may offer an easily obtainable source of abundant food. This late summer increase in predation may also be related to learning or development of livestock killing behavior by the coyote pups. Winter losses of livestock to coyotes are generally lower than at other times of year, despite the high energy needs of individual coyotes. From the K-State Research and Extension Wildcat District, this has been a Davin Strauss with your K-State Research and Extension Report.
Thank you, Davin. And now, here is Jesse Gilmore with his report.
With K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, this is Jesse Gilmore bringing you this week's edition of the Hort Report. Trees are finally turning to their fall colors as the temperatures cool off and the leaves slowly drop. Some leaves in your yard can be good, but too much leaf coverage can block your lawn from building up carbohydrate reserves it needs to get through the winter. You can mulch your yard with broken down leaf litter, but if you already recycle grass clippings or if there are too many leaves, you will want to remove the leaves to avoid excessive thatch buildup. When recycling small amounts of leaves in your lawn, you will want to mow over them with your mower at the highest possible deck height. This will tear up leaves into smaller pieces that will make it easier for your lawn to get the sun it needs and will speed up the decomposition process of the leaf litter. If you instead want to use the leaf litter in the garden or in a compost pile, you will still need to mow over the leaves, but instead use a bag attachment. This will break down the leaves into smaller pieces and collect them in one place for you to distribute where they are needed. You will likely have more leaves than you can use in your own compost pile, so municipal compost and burn piles, or fire pits, are other options for getting rid of excess leaves. When composting yard debris, be sure not to include wood, as this takes much longer to break down. Leaves change color once chlorophyll is destroyed in the early fall and other pigments begin reflecting light. Orange and yellow pigments are present in the leaf throughout the year, while red and purple pigments are created after the chlorophyll is destroyed. The sunnier it is before the leaves are cut off from the rest of the tree as it preps for dormancy, the stronger the fall color will be. More sun leads to more photosynthesis, which leads to more sugars trapped in the leaves. If fall colors look unusually dingy, the recent weather is likely to blame. There are ways to increase the likelihood of good fall color in your landscape trees. Trees with large leaves or thick canopies will be able to photosynthesize more, which leads to those high sugar levels the leaves need for a vibrant hue. Fall is the best time to buy and plant a tree, especially if you are trying to preview what the normal fall color of an individual will look like. Keep in mind that the species of tree and the recent weather will both have a strong influence on the color of the tree you're previewing. A tree that looks drab at the garden center might be stressed out enough to not have the strong fall color you're looking for, but would brighten up once it establishes and has diligent management from you. Selecting for fall color should always be secondary to putting the right-sized tree in the right space, but assuming that characteristic requirement is met, choosing a well-colored tree will give the tree seasonal interest in your landscape for years to come. For more information on today's topic, contact your local Extension office. I can be reached at 620-724-8233 or by email at jr637@ksu.edu. Once again, this has been Jesse Gilmore bringing you this week's Hort Report.
Thank you, Jesse, and thank you for listening to K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District Ag Team on KGGF 690 Radio.